Blog Talk Radio.
This program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Basically, the 1% of the motorcycle community who operates outside the law.
Their total focus is on nature for the enemy. They have a policy of shoot or kill on sight if they can.
It's bullshit. Law enforcement just tries to paint this picture to the media to just cover up their bullshit, cover up their lies, and I just like to say fuck them. That's straight from Mike P.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
What's up? How's the baby?
It's okay.
And how are you?
I'm okay.
Yeah? Sound like you're preoccupied.
No.
Okay. Well, I got a couple of emails. A few emails, but people want to hear that don't talk to the police thing again. So while I'm waiting for something, and a couple other people that are supposed to call in, I'm going to play that right now. And then I'll open up for questions after, okay?
Okay.
All right. Be right back.
I was invited to give you a taste of a typical law school classroom experience here today, and I thought I would take advantage of this opportunity to do something that's been on my mind for a while, to stand up and to proudly say, God bless America, God bless the Bill of Rights, and thank God for the Fifth Amendment. I'm not ashamed to say I'm proud of the Fifth Amendment, and I'm proud to admit on camera and on the Internet that I will never talk to any police officer under any circumstances, with all due respect, sir. I'm doing something really extraordinary here today, something you'll almost never see another law professor do as long as you live. I'm really putting myself on the spot here. This was my idea. By my invitation, I have given up half of my time, approximately. I'm giving equal time and the last word to an expert who really knows something about what I'll be talking about. So I'm opening myself up to the possibility that he will contradict me. I was a criminal defense attorney when I was in private practice. So I want to make sure, in fairness to you, if I'm misleading you or giving you a slanted or one-sided presentation, you'll be able to get the last word from somebody else. I'm sure he'll have a lot to teach all of us, including myself. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution provides, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And this unfortunate amendment has gotten a bad rap in recent times, much of it tragically and unnecessarily through, as you may have heard, the headlines. There was a recent Regent Law School graduate who was in all the news for a couple of weeks. She was an outstanding former student of mine. And she really got quite a lot of undeserved flack for the fact that she chose to exercise her right to remain silent when the Senate wanted to ask her certain questions that arguably might have tended to incriminate her. All of the world was aghast. The Christian community in particular looked at this and said, how could a Christian do such a thing? How could a Christian take the Fifth Amendment? And I said, you go, girlfriend. I do the same thing. I'll do it every time. And I want to talk to you about why that's true, but first a quick listening test. Let me read to you something that was taken out of the newspaper this morning, and I want you to listen to it closely. And I'm giving you a heads up. I'm warning you in advance, which is not fair to you. Not fair to me, but I'm giving you a warning that I'll be quizzing you on this in just a few minutes. This will test your aptitude for legal study and legal practice. Listen closely. It won't take long. Last night, agents of the Norfolk Police Department found three victims of an apparent murder dead in an apartment in the East Ocean View area, the apparent victims of a gangland-style slaying, and possibly the victims of gang-related violence. The police are investigating this as a possible murder and suicide, but right now suspect that the three were all killed by the same individual. No suspects have yet been identified in the slaying, but veteran police detective George Brook has confirmed that police are following up on evidence pointing to the possible involvement of an off-duty naval officer as the perpetrator. The bodies, which were found by the apartment manager at about 8 o'clock in the morning, appear to have been slain sometime earlier in the same evening, probably sometime between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. Those are all the facts I'll ask you to remember, and it won't be for very long either. Let's see how well you do. I'll be quizzing you in just a few minutes. Now, here's the easiest question you'll ever get from a client in all the days of your life. Question, hey, the police are here. They want to talk to me. What should I do? Well, I could give you my answer to that question in case you haven't already guessed it, but why don't we go to a real expert, Justice Robert Jackson. A prosecutor's prosecutor. Like me, he began his private practice in Buffalo, New York, years before I did. And after that, he served as general counsel for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the U.S. Department of Treasury, the Securities and Exchange Commission, Assistant U.S. Attorney General for the Tax Division, later the Solicitor General and the Attorney General of the United States, and then the Chief U.S. Prosecutor for the Nuremberg Trials. That's an impressive resume. Years later, when he was a justice on the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson stated, quote, any lawyer worth his salt, today we would say his or her, will tell the suspect, his client, in no uncertain terms to make no statement to the police under any circumstances. There's the title of my talk. I'm here to explain to you the surprising and somewhat counterintuitive and admittedly unlikely reasons why Justice Jackson was right. I'm reminded of this because I'm amazed, we're all amazed, by the frequency with which we see newspaper articles coming out all the time from people who really ought to know better, who say, well, I'll talk to the police. I mean, after all, I'm a senator. I'm O.J. Simpson. I'm an experienced, highly polished individual. I've got a lot of experience with public relations, even criminal defense attorneys. There was a local news story here in the Virginia Pilot just a couple of months ago about an experienced criminal defense lawyer who ended up getting convicted of criminal assault because he talked to the police. He was accused of having assaulted another attorney in the hallway. There were no other witnesses to this. A woman said that he grabbed her by the throat during an argument over a case. He denied it. At trial, it was his word against her. He said, I did not even touch her. But unfortunately for him, when the police had approached him earlier and said, would you be willing to answer some questions? He said, sure, why not? I'm an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm savvy. I'm sophisticated. I've got oratorical prowess. I'm accustomed to dealing with the police, by all means. And then there was a conversation that was not recorded. When the case went to trial, it was no longer his word against hers, because when he testified at trial, I never touched her. The officer took to the stand and testified, well, when I met with him, he said he did put his hand on her throat, but just as a joke. Then he had to take the stand again and say, that's not true. I never said that. I never admitted to you that I... Now it's his word against two people. Who's telling the truth? We'll never know for sure. But he was found guilty. Now, here's part of the problem. The heart of the problem, as Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court explained in 1998, is, quote, the complexity of modern federal criminal law, codified in several thousand sections of the United States Code, and the virtually infinite variety of factual circumstances that might trigger an investigation into a possible violation of the law, make it difficult for anyone to know in advance just when a particular statement might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant to some investigation. One expert on criminal law recently noted that estimates of the current size of the body of federal criminal law vary, although it has been reported that the Congressional Research Service can no longer even count the current number of federal crimes. That's right. Even the federal government has lost count. These laws are scattered over all 50 pages of the U.S. Code, encompassing roughly 27,000 pages. Worse yet, these statutes often incorporate by reference to the provisions of administrative regulations. Estimates of how many such regulations exist are even less well settled, although the ABA thinks there may be nearly 10,000. Here's one of those 10,000 federal criminal statutes on the book that you probably never heard about. It's called the Lacey Act. 16 U.S.C. Section 3370 says it's a federal offense for any person to import, export, transport, sell, receive, acquire, or purchase any fish or wildlife or plant taken, possessed, transported, or sold in a violation of any law, treaty, or regulation of the United States or any Indian tribal law or any state or any foreign law. People have been convicted in federal court for violating this statute because they brought back a bony fish from Honduras, not knowing that Honduran law, not American, but Honduran law, forbade the possession of the bony fish. People have been convicted under this law because they were found in possession of what's called a short lobster, a lobster that's under a certain size. Some states forbid you from possessing a lobster if he's under a certain length. It doesn't matter if he's dead or alive. It doesn't matter if you killed it or if he died of natural causes. It doesn't even matter if you acted in self-defense. Did you know that? Did you know it could be a federal offense to be in possession of a lobster? Admit it. Raise your hand if you did not know that. There's the problem. And that's only one of 10,000 different ways. You know, the government gets pretty upset when people like me instruct the client, people like me and Justice Jackson, don't talk to the police, don't answer any questions. But, you know, they can't have it both ways. You people, you've got 10,000 different ways of convicting us. Good for you. But, you know, with the bitter comes to the sweet, with the good comes to the bad. That's 10,000 different ways my client might unknowingly implicate himself in some sort of a criminal transaction. One of the reasons I decided to give this talk, I recently received a phone call from a former student of mine, a regional law school graduate, who may be watching this online. We're putting it on the internet. And he told me, hey, I've been approached by the Internal Revenue Service. They want to ask me a couple of questions. They ask if I'd be willing to. But they say that I'm not a suspect, and I know in my heart I don't think I've done anything wrong in violation of the Internal Revenue Service provisions. Lord have mercy. There's no man on earth, there's no woman in this country who can honestly say with complete confidence, I know I have never violated any provision of the Internal Revenue Code. He said, but they say I'm not a suspect, and I know I've done nothing wrong. It's okay if I talk to him. I said, no, No, you tell them you will not talk to them without immunity. I explained to him why that was true, and he never heard from them again. Okay, why you should never talk to the police. Let me just spell it out for you. Let me make it plain to all of you. These are the top 10 reasons. I don't want to actually really lie to you. I don't really have 10. I don't have time for 10. But I've got time for 8, and that'll be close enough. Number one, and this really ought to be good enough. Contrary to what you laymen instinctively and naturally suppose, it cannot help. There is no way it can help you. Plenty of folks think that it can, and they're always wrong. You cannot talk your way out of getting arrested. Officer Brooke, you've interviewed thousands of criminal suspects. How many times in your experience have you approached someone, asked if you could ask them some questions because prior to the interview you had some evidence pointing to his possible guilt? And because of the extraordinary persuasiveness and eloquence with which he articulated his innocence, you said, oh, sorry, never mind. Bad call, my bad, I won't. And he talked you out of arresting him. Never. Never. It never happens. I've often asked other criminal defense attorneys, in all of your experience, have you ever once had a case where you looked back in hindsight and said, thank God my client talked to the police? They laugh at me. They laugh at me. They say, you've got to be kidding me. It cannot help you. You can't talk your way out of getting arrested. And contrary to what you might suppose if you never studied the rules of evidence, what you tell the police, even if it's exculpatory, cannot be used to help you at trial. Because it's what we call hearsay. Under the rules of evidence, specifically rule 801D2A, if you want to look it up, everything you tell the police, as the saying goes, can and will be used against you, but it cannot be used for you. From time to time, I've known attorneys who tried to call to the stand a police officer and say, officer, would you tell the jury what my client told you because what my client told him was actually good for my case? If you tried that at trial, the prosecutor will object to it as hearsay, and the judge will agree. The police will not be allowed, at your request, to tell the jury what your client told him, no matter how good it may be for your case. It cannot help. And that ought to be good enough reason. That ought to be reason enough to keep your mouth shut. But if you're not persuaded, let me go talk about a couple of others. Number two, obviously one of the most obvious, if your client is guilty, as many of them are, but even if he's not, even if he's innocent, he may well admit his guilt with no benefit in return. Now, of course, many of you are thinking to yourself, well, what's so wrong about that? I mean, shouldn't guilty people be confessing? Confession's good for the soul. It's good for law enforcement. It's good for the prisons. Yes, yeah, sure, all those things are true. And like the rest of you, if I or anyone close to me is ever the victim of some sort of a serious crime, I hope they get the right guy. I hope they convict him. I hope they put him away. We all feel that way. Hey, but what's the rush, friends? You don't got to admit your guilt the first time they come by to meet with you. In federal court, 86% of all defendants plead guilty at some point before trial. If your client is guilty and really ought to punish and really ought to have go through some sort of a cleansing act of contrition and fess up and admit his guilt, there'll be plenty of time to do that. They almost always do. No need to rush. No need to tell the police something. Wait and see perhaps your client can work out some sort of an arrangement where maybe he'll make some sort of compensation to the alleged victim, or maybe he'll be able to get some sort of a discount in his sentence, and he'll be treated fairly then, like everybody else who had the benefit of a good lawyer who said, please do not talk to the police. And don't forget, by the way, even if your client only admits things that the police already knew, you might think, well, what harm can it do? He says he wants to talk to the police. All he wants to do is admit that he was there. But the cops know that he was there. All right, go ahead and tell them. Well, how can it hurt? It might hurt. If the police officer becomes transferred to Minnesota or deceased or injured or comatose or cannot be located by the time of trial, the case will be dismissed if there's no confession. But if your client admits two things, now that confession is freely admissible against him. It can be a basis for getting him convicted all by himself. Then Larry Craig can explain all of this to you. The Innocence Project of the United States has confirmed that in more than 25% of all the cases where an innocent man was convicted and then later released from prison after he was exonerated by DNA evidence, in more than a quarter of those cases, these innocent people we know to be innocent, made incriminating statements, delivered outright confessions, or pled guilty. How do they do that? He'll tell us all about it, I trust. Here's a couple of famous examples. You can just ask them. You don't have to take my word for it. There on the left was Eddie Joe Lloyd. He was convicted in 1984 of the murder of a 16-year-old girl in Detroit, after he wrote to police with suggestions on how to solve various recent crimes. During several interviews, police fed details of the crime to Mr. Lloyd, who was mentally ill, and they lied to him and convinced this mentally ill man that by confessing, he might help them smoke out the real killer. He later signed a confession, gave a tape-recorded statement. The jury delivered it less than 1 hour before convicting him on the basis of this confession. There was no other substantial evidence against him. The judge said, I'd hang you if I could, but the death penalty was not available in Michigan at the time. But after almost 2 decades in prison, he was released after DNA evidence proved that this man was innocent and had falsely confessed to a crime that he did not commit. On the right is Earl Washington, who was released from prison just a few years ago here in Virginia after spending 18 years behind bars after being committed of a rape and a murder that we now know he did not commit after having been exonerated by DNA evidence. So see, this man, Mr. Washington, who was in fact confirmed to be mentally retarded, was able to confess to several crimes at the request of the police, some of which we know he could not have committed. That's the problem. Some of you are thinking to yourself, well, none of this concerns me because I'm not guilty of anything and I never will be and I will never represent people who do. Okay. Let's talk to you people. You innocent folks. Those of you who have never committed a crime and never will, and none of your clients will either. And you wouldn't go out with a girl who did. Fine. You better not talk to the police either. Okay? Because number three, we'll put the guilty behind us. Forget about them. Let's talk about innocent people. Number three, even if your client is innocent and he denies his guilt and almost entirely tells the truth, odds are good he will easily get carried away and tell some little lie or make some little mistake that will hang him. This is human nature. He gets in there, it's a stressful situation. Imagine a perfectly innocent client. The police say he's been guilty of a murder. He's totally innocent as any one of us. So he goes in there and he meets with the police. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. I was nowhere near there. I didn't kill him. I've never killed anybody. I don't have a gun. I've never had a gun. I've never touched a gun in my life. I was nowhere near Virginia Beach that night. That last line was a lie. He went over the top. He was getting carried away. He got into this groove. He started saying all kinds of things, almost all of them true, that he knew would tend to exculpate himself. Then he got carried away and just said one thing that wasn't true, and unfortunately for him, they can prove that it wasn't true. He may be convicted on that basis alone. But let's say, well, that's not a problem. I'll tell my client only to tell the truth. I've met with him. I know he won't lie to the police. He won't make any mistakes. Okay, that's still no guarantee you won't be getting into trouble. Because even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't say anything that is false, now, already, mind you, we're pretty well nigh into fantasy land. The odds of this being anybody being able to pull this off are really quite slim, no matter how innocent they may be. But just for the same, let's pretend. Let's assume he gives the police nothing but the truth, and he is totally innocent. He will always give the police some information that can be used to help convict him. Always. For example, suppose you tell this to the police. Here's what your client tells to the police in his denial of guilt. I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't kill Jones. I don't know who did. I wasn't anywhere near that place. I don't have a gun. I've never owned a gun in my life. I don't even know how to use a gun. Yeah, sure, I never liked the guy, but who did? I wouldn't kill him. I've never hurt anybody in my life, and I would never do such a thing. Let's suppose every word of that is true, 100% of it is true. What will the jury hear at trial? Officer Brooke, was there anything about this, your interrogation, your interview with the suspect that made you concerned that he might be the right one? Yes, there was. He confessed to me that he never liked the guy. And then the prosecutor put that up in big letters, and he'll say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it's pretty clear that we've got the right guy here. We've proven that he was in Virginia Beach that night. That's opportunity. And remember, Officer Brooke admitted that after extended questioning, he was finally able to get the defendant to admit that he never liked the guy. There's your motive. Motive plus opportunity. Wham, bam. Please. But jury's heated up. And innocent people get convicted this way sometimes. How often? Hopefully not too often, but we know what happens. The United States Supreme Court, don't take my word for this, in Ohio versus Reiner, the Supreme Court of the United States said, quote, one of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocents who otherwise might be ensnared by ambiguous circumstances. Truthful responses of an innocent witness, as well as those of a wrongdoer, may provide the government with incriminating evidence from the speaker's own mouth. See, it's not just some criminal defense attorney telling you this. Even the Supreme Court says I'm right. In the fact, under the facts of that case, by the way, in Ohio versus Reiner, a child tragically was died, apparently the result of shaken baby syndrome. The question was who had shaken this baby to death. And one of the possible suspects was a babysitter who had spent some time with the child that week. The babysitter's story was, I don't know what you're talking about. I did not kill the child. I did not see it happen. I don't know who shook the baby. It was never me. I never did anything of any violent nature to the child. The Ohio State Court said, well, you've got no Fifth Amendment privilege. You, by your own admission, told the investigators that you've done nothing wrong, that you were not involved, so obviously your answers can't incriminate you. The United States Supreme Court reversed and said, well, that's not true. Even though this babysitter denies shaking the child, denies seeing the child die, denies knowing how the child died, this babysitter, by her own admission, apparently the government wanted to ask whether the babysitter might have been with the child at some point that week, during the week prior to the death. And that answer, although by itself not sufficient to convict anybody, could help convict her. That means she's got a Fifth Amendment right to have refused to answer the question the court held, because it could be used to help convict. Ullman versus United States, the Supreme Court said more than 50 years ago, eerily prophetic, they said too many Americans, even those who should be better advised, view this privilege as a shelter for wrongdoers. They too readily assume that those who invoke it are either guilty of crime or commit perjury and claim the privilege. That's not true, and it never has been. But it gets worse. Can it get worse? It can. Number five, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and does not tell the police anything incriminating, which, by the way, is almost impossible to pull this off. Can you imagine talking to the police for 2, 3, 4 hours and somebody like him can't somehow manage to extract from you something that could be used to help convict you? Better be extraordinary. I don't think anybody's pulled it off. But even if you could pull it off, there's still a grave chance that his answers can and will be used to crucify you in a court of law if the police, no offense, don't recall his testimony with 100% accuracy. All right, now this brings us back to that pop quiz I warned you about. I told you earlier, remember, it's only been a few minutes, and you weren't up all night, and you weren't the subject of physical duress. You were in the relaxed setting of a classroom here. You were given heads-up advance notice that you would be quizzed on this. Question. We'll start with a couple of easy ones. Remember that article I read you about this? How many people did the police find shot to death last night at that Ocean View apartment that I told you about? A, 1, B, 2, C, 3, D, 4. Who says A? B. C. Get this. Get that with a camera. Sure, get this. Move that camera out. Look how many hands we've got there for C. Okay, D. Because you're all wrong. Everybody who raised their hand, you are the kind of people who should never talk to the police under any circumstances for as long as you live. Why is C not the right answer, by the way? If you know, raise your hand. Yes. Excellent. I didn't say anybody was shot. I didn't say gun, bullet, shooting, firearms. Didn't use any of those words. But I don't blame you if you thought that I did. This is the way the human mind works. We hear things. We fill in details. I said gangland-style slang. That may or may not imply something, but it doesn't mean that anybody was shot. And that's the problem. You see, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell them anything incriminating and his statement is videotaped, his answers can be used to crucify him. You might say, wait, how can that happen? I insisted. In my insistence, I called the police and I said, look, if you want to talk to my client, you can talk to him, but only if you videotape the whole thing. I don't want there to be any debate between the two of you over what happened. Okay, we'll videotape the whole thing. If the police don't recall their questions with 100% accuracy, he'll be convicted on that statement alone. For example, suppose a man goes to the police. They say, we're investigating a possible murder. A shooting. And the guy says, quote, I don't know who killed Jones, Officer Brooke, with all due respect. It wasn't me. I've never touched or fired a gun in my life. How can that help incriminate this man? How could that possibly be used against this man? Convict him. You would think it's inconceivable. But it's as easy as pie. All the officer has to do is read the statement to the jury, and then the prosecutor says, Officer Brooke, was there anything about that statement that confused you or surprised you? Yes, there was, he says in a moment of sinister high ground in the courtroom. And what was that? And then Officer Brooke turns to the jurors and he says, I never said anything about a shooting. I said we were investigating a murder. He was the one who brought up a gun. Then you turn to your client, and your client says, That's not true. I remember he was the one, or one of the cops. I was with them for 3 hours. One of them in the car said something about, they said they had a witness that I was the shooter. Okay, I'll put you on the stand. And then your client testifies, No, they did tell me shooting. They mentioned it before I said anything about a gun. They brought it up first. And then the police said, that's not true. And now what, it's your word against theirs? For what? You're gambling with your client's life. And police officers can very easily make a mistake like that, just as so many of you did just a few minutes ago. Whether you recalled having heard me say something about somebody actually being shot. Police make mistakes, innocently, inadvertently, unintentionally, any statement.
But if you make a mistake, you get fucked. They don't. Are you there, Sunshine?
Yep.
What do you think?
And you know what? It's true.
What?
That's true.
That is true.
You know, people sit there and, you know, I like when they sit there and we're here to protect and serve. No, they're there to lie to you so they can make up something and lock your ass up.
Well, they're paid to lie.
Exactly. They're not actually paid enough to lie, but to them, I guess, I think it is a lot.
Oh, no. Then they got something to talk about at the water cooler or at the donut shop.
Yeah. Ready for Dunkin' Donuts.
All right. Let me wrap this up with this guy.
Okay.
No matter how exculpatory it may seem on its face, can be used to crucify you all by itself if the police are either willing to lie, not likely, or if they just have an innocent misrecollection of the details as to what they did and did not tell you before you told them what you said. All of these, by the way, all of these problems disappear if you take Justice Jackson's advice and say, thank you very much, officer, but no thanks. How about this one? Here we go. Now, here's the most surprising of all. I saved the most surprising one for a last. Let's suppose you've got the following scenario. Your client's thinking about talking to the police. He acts like he says, I've got nothing to hide. They think that I killed somebody in Virginia Beach last night. Well, this is what your client tells you in confidence. I don't know who robbed that store. It wasn't me. In fact, I got a pretty good alibi. I wasn't even in Virginia Beach that night, last night. I was 4 hours away visiting my mother in the Outer Banks. Unfortunately, no, I did not pay for gas with a credit card. I used cash, and so I've got no witnesses that can prove I was there except my word, and of course, Mama, for what that's worth, which is nothing. So your client says, well, so the police want to talk to me, and I want to seem cooperative, so what I'll do is I'll tell them that I was in the Outer Banks last night. Now, there's nothing on its face incriminating about any of that. Let's assume, by the way, that you believe with all your doubt, you've given your client a polygraph exam. You've known him for years. You've been going to the same Bible study for 30 years. You know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's telling you the truth. And he's not admitting anything. He's not admitting motive. He's not admitting opportunity. He's not admitting that he was there. How on earth could this come back to haunt us? How on earth could this come back to be used against us? Be honest. Raise your hand if you really think the answer to that question is, I can't see how it could possibly be used against us. You're afraid I'll call on you, right? I won't call on you. Well, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. You're always wrong. Everything you say, every time you talk to the police, you will regret it. You see, the problem is, here it is. This is the last point. I think it's almost the same. Even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell the police anything incriminating, and the entire interview, questions and answers, are videotaped, even his truthful answers can be helped to use crucify even an innocent man if the police, through no fault of theirs, end up in the possession of any evidence, even mistaken and unreliable evidence, that anything your client told them was false, even if in fact it was true. Again, going back to this example from a moment ago. Let's suppose I go ahead and I meet with the police. I guess I think I got nothing to hide. I tell them I was in the Outer Banks last night, officer. I cannot help at all by itself. But what if I later find out, to my horror, after I put my cards on the table, that they've got a witness, a girl that I went to high school with, an unimpeachable witness. We've never been enemies. She'd have no reason to lie. She swears she thinks she saw me in Virginia Beach last night, a couple of blocks away from that store, about an hour before it was robbed. Now, her testimony by itself isn't going to help the prosecutor. Hell, if she's all they've got, I'll get this case thrown out before trial. But if, like an idiot, I talked to the police and I told them the truth, I told them I was in the Outer Banks, and now, lo and behold, tragically, it turns out they've got a witness, a false, mistaken, confused, but sincere and credible witness, who can testify that I was here in Virginia Beach, now they're likely to get a conviction. Because what they'll...
So, basically, the most famous two words Bill and I live by religiously, shut up.
There's a lot of people that don't know how.
Yeah.
That's why that was so perfect, because how many people sit there, blah, 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 and before any more than five words are said. I've seen it. And I sat there and thought, what the hell?
Mm-hmm. Let me play this song, because I got to fix something. I'll be right back.
Okay.
This one's by Atticus 7. It's called Into the Blackness. Be right back after this. Thank you. got that straightened out. So, what did you think about that?
About the video?
Mm-hmm.
I think about how many stupid people are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the ones that know what not to do.
Just like you said, whatever you say can or will be used against you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. I've had idiots look at me like I did something wrong. It's like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Ready for this one?
Sure.
They got a Senate bill rewrite that lets the feds read your emails.
Oh, I ain't worried about that, you know? If they want to see about, not that mine would, but if mine were to say, you know, this one can suck on a dick and die, well, hey, have at it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, check your email.
Yeah, I have to be able to get in there.
Oh, okay. But yeah, there's a Senate proposal being touted as to protect American email privacy has been quietly rewritten, giving all the government agencies more surveillance power than they possess under the current law.
It's just another excuse for them to do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah. Patrick Leahy, he's the Democratic chairman of the Senate Judiciary. He said he reshaped the whole legislation in response to law enforcement concerns. So they basically vote on this bill, which now authorizes warrantless access to the Americans' emails. It's scheduled for next week. Yep, 22 agencies.
Unbelievable. You know, we're not going to get around so much crap after so long anyways. There's only certain things we're able to do with the minor privacy issue. Minor. You know, it's not like what it used to be way before when. But even then, did we really actually have it? Probably not. They just, that was a fairy tale for us all to feel safe. To see how stupid people would be to say, hey, I can say this. Nobody's listening.
Yeah. Well, basically, the highlights of this bill are it grants warrantless access to electronic correspondence over 22 federal agencies. Only a subpoena is required, not a search warrant signed by a judge based on probable cause. And it permits the states and local law enforcement to warrantlessly access your correspondence stored on systems not offered to the public, including university networks. It also authorizes law enforcement agency to access accounts without a warrant or subsequent court review if they claim emergency situations exist. And it says, providers shall notify law enforcement in advance of the plans to tell their customers they've been the target of a warrant, order, or a subpoena. And it also delays notification of customers whose accounts have been accessed from 3 days to 10 business days. This notification will be posted by up to 360 days.
Okay. Well, let's go back to this point. Excuse me. Anyways, when it comes to our cell phone carriers, they always state they do not share information with third-person parties. We also know it's a fact that any cop can go in and do what they want with our records, okay? So, let's see, AT&T is a huge provider, not only for phone, TV, also email. Okay, so of course they're going to sit there and use their lame excuse. We do not give your information out to third-person parties, and we will not have anybody know your information. Too late, they already do. Okay, so a rule of thumb, if it takes writing it on a piece of paper, you know, like we used to do back in the day, passing notes in school, you know, guess what? They can't hear what you're saying. if you're not speaking it.
That's true.
You know, write a letter. Do something, because they hear no matter what. They hear if you're talking. They know who's coming around your home. They know so much of what you're doing. That's crazy. Do I care? No.
Well, you don't care now, but you're gonna.
Exactly.
You know, it all goes back to basically what do they do to get in, is they blame it on something. You've got to have some catastrophe for everybody to jump on the bandwagon and say, absolutely, tap my phones because I'm not a criminal. Well, before you know it, you're making the decision. You know, who decides who's the criminal and who's not? Your privacy is shot to shit because you're monitored 24/7. Your cell phone, your pager, everything that you do goes through a central database, because it's all got to go through circuitry just like the old phone did, and there's a digital record of it. So
it all goes through you on that new fusion center.
Yeah,
right.
That was it. $3 billion facility they're building?
Yeah,
yep.
In Utah. Yeah.
So, you know, you've got all of that happening. Well, guess what? You've got somebody that's going to be monitoring that, and the keywords flying up. Go back to the RICO Act. If you and me are buddies and a buddy of yours does something stupid and they track through that somehow or another we're connected, I mean, they've got a way of tying everybody up to figure out how you're a criminal, whether you are or not.
Yeah.
We already know that. But then there's the other side of it where you don't have to have a record. It doesn't matter what you do or what you don't do in your privacy or in your non-privacy part of life. They can come and detain you and arrest you for whatever reason they want.
Well, yeah,
you
thanks
could
to
be
the new
tired.
Act that's been put in where they can detain a U.S. citizen for no cause for an undetermined amount of time without even a call to an attorney.
Exactly. Okay.
And, you know, that was done under the... That was done
sorry,
because of some terrorist situation. Well, what pisses me off is the terrorists are getting set free and turned loose and everything else, and the American citizens are getting jacked around and having to follow all these laws. The damn terrorists have more rights than we do.
Exactly. I had a cop come and knock on my door because my cordless phone, supposedly, okay, the battery needed to be charged. I knew that. And it sent a signal of 911. Are you kidding me? Do you think I'm stupid?
Well, some of those cordless phones you can pick up with a baby monitor if you're within a couple hundred feet.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know,
but,
there are so little number of signals. I mean, there's at one point, there were very few signals. And so, you know, it's back to the old party line days. Hell, you got five people listening in on your conversation.
Right.
You know.
But have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, it's
is a cop coming and knocking on your door. You called 911? No. Do you have a cordless phone? Yes. Then you have to charge your battery.
I think they do that in case, for instance, you get hurt. And this is a situation where they do it on your behalf to start with, but then that allows them access to more stuff.
I don't like to
fall,
get them information.
You know, but you fall, you drop your phone, and you had it on. So it's sitting there, the battery's running out, it never called anybody. It would automatically trip them to do that. Could be a good situation for somebody that's, you know, in dire need. But then again, it falls onto you, and you got somebody knocking on your door. So how do we establish these boundaries where they know who the hell to leave alone?
Well, same thing with your butt dial.
Yep.
Or pocket dial. I've had so many people do that to me. It's like your pocket called me or your butt called me.
Right.
No, I understand what you're saying. We have nothing. It's been gone out the window. But it doesn't matter if you have a pass or if you don't have a pass. If you could sit there and work a 15-hour shift, okay, and you're driving home, you're tired, or you just get home, and for some ungodly reason, they decide to roll up, okay, and they can look at you, your eyes, you're tired, they may look bloodshot or something, right away. Have you been drinking?
Hey, Magoo.
What is your problem?
When you say, no, you're going to go to jail, you keep talking like that.
Well, what I mean is, you know, how much further does it have to go? I mean, you could sit there and be very polite and No, officer. I just got off from work.
I don't
be very cordial.
I don't answer questions.
I understand that, but I'm speaking in regards to somebody stupid enough.
Don't say that.
Well,
yeah.
And right there, it gives them a probable cause.
Oh, yeah, it does, because you forgot those two famous words.
Shut up.
Shut up, yeah.
I know.
Am I under arrest? Am I free to go?
Exactly.
But I'm talking, I'm using that as an example in regards to somebody being stupid and not paying attention to their rights.
Then they deserve
right.
to go to
exactly.
Well, so many people are uninformed, and you know what? I've got friends that are cops, and they're great people. They do their job. They're honest, whatever. Some of them aren't. And it doesn't come down to who is or isn't honest. It comes down to your right is you don't have to tell them anything. Doesn't matter if they're the best person in the world. You don't have to say squat. So people need to realize that.
You don't even have to show them an ID.
No.
All you got to do is tell them your name and your birth date.
Yep. I mean, they can pull all the rest of your information off your license plate if you get pulled over, so they don't need to get it anyway.
No, they already
everything
know
up to and including insurance records.
Yep.
So, you know.
It's like,
well, they pull that up, and one of my buddies is a highway patrolman, and he says that when he pulls somebody over, of course, everything comes up. And it'll tell them whether or not they're licensed to carry concealed. And he said that's the best thing ever because if it's somebody that is licensed to carry concealed, that he feels more secure about it because they've already passed all of these FBI background checks and everything else. So, you know, it's more of a comfortable situation for him on one hand. But, you know, they've got all your information. So you don't have to give them crap. You don't have to tell them anything.
If they ask you, is it loaded? What do you think?
Well, yeah. What's the point of, having it if it's not loaded? It's my right to carry it.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Michigan the other day, on December 5th, they passed a bill blocking NDAA detention. And put the link up in the chat. It's House Bill 5768. And what it says is, HB 5768 declares no agency of this state, no political subdivision of this state, no employees of an agency of this state or political subdivision of this state acting in his or her official capacity and no member of the Michigan National Guard or official state duty shall and aid an agency of the armed forces of the United States in any investigation, prosecution, detention of any person pursuant to 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Wow, and that passed in the Senate?
Yep.
Nice. I'm kind of looking at it now. It's kind of garbled up a little on my page here. A whole bunch of PDF stuff I'm just trying to skim through.
Yeah,
that's good news.
It passed the House, and then it was on to the Senate.
Nice.
Hmm?
So, the other good thing is the Chicago law going through that banned the concealed weapon thing they were trying to do.
Yeah.
No, they didn't ban it. It got overruled.
Right, yeah, the ban got overruled.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's good news.
Yep.
Yes, it is.
So, and that was the only state that was trying to do it. Yeah.
Because Feinstein out here, who has a concealed weapons permit, and says she doesn't. But it claims congressional power to pass legislation to detain people on U.S. soil. It is the duty of state legislators to interpose and stop the progress of evil. I mean, what can be more evil than government-sanctioned kidnapping?
Yeah.
Exactly.
And they get away with it. Why? Because of who they are.
Well, because nobody has the balls to stand up and tell them to kidnap, get the Constitution.
Right, but if you wanted to go and kidnap your friend, well, guess what? You can't, well, not a friend, but if someone you know, guess what? You're going to jail for life.
Yeah.
On kidnapping conspiracy charges. But if they do it to you, they get away with it.
Oh, absolutely.
Look, when you see black helicopters in the middle of the night doing ops downtown L.A., downtown San Diego, you think they're doing that for exercise?
No. They're not stupid.
Mm-hmm. like all these police departments got that $300,000 vehicle that's bomb proof and everything else. They don't need that.
Yeah, I was kind of under the impression that's what the National Guard was for, is in situations like that.
No, they're training them. They're training them to arrest people. Pendleton has two places out here doing that right now.
Really?
Mm-hmm. For the last 7 months.
I already knew that. Yeah, and look at Florida.
They started 3 police battalions.
And look at Florida. Military. Going down the roads. Guess what? That's coming.
Sorry, I'm still trying to read through all this HB bill you posted a little bit ago.
Yeah, it's all crazy, man.
So what do you think about the whole deficit spending situation that got doubled?
Well,
supposed
I don't
to have
know. Somebody spent $4 million on 3 weeks in Hawaii, and it was mine and your dime.
Right. Yeah. No, we spent that money for him to go to Hawaii for 3 weeks.
I didn't spend it. Maybe you did. I didn't.
Well, I pay taxes, so that's how that worked. But
yeah, I paid that under.
Now we've got this huge deficit and passed a bill that approved $800 billion, and that's all been handled, and now all of a sudden it's $1.6
trillion, mm-hmm.
with $600 billion actually going to the actual deficit reduction, and $1.2 going to new spending. How the hell does that work? That's like me taking out a loan from Nora for $600 to fix my car, giving that money to somebody else, borrowing a whole shit ton of money from you to pay Nora back because I don't want the other dude to pay back, and they just keep borrowing against borrowing. They've got no damn sense. There's no way in hell to keep borrowing money from everybody and raising the deficit if you're not going to pay the damn thing off. I don't get it. Driving us into the shithole and everybody's throwing praises that way.
You know, if you get a chance, you might want to read Civil Disobedience by Henry David Thoreau.
Okay.
I'm going to put that up in the chat room right now. Pretty good
read.
Pretty good read. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, if you bend over once, you're going to...
Yeah, you bend over a little bit, but you get free health care, so you don't bitch.
No, you don't get free health care. You got to pay for
it. Well, yeah, you do. You have to pay for it, but that's the guise of it. They tell you you're getting free health care, and everybody jumps on the bandwagon, but every time they're giving you something, they're taking it from somebody else.
Pay for
it. And before you know it, they're coming after you for shit you don't have because they're paying for somebody else that's not working.
For a family of three, it's going to be $275 to $385, depending on what part of the country you live in.
Yeah. Nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get it.
Nope, I don't get it either. I'll send you that link in the chat right now.
Okay. Right on, there it is.
But yeah, there's three parts to that. Right.
Cool.
The first line, I heartily accept the motto that that government is best, governs least. And that government is best when which governs not all. But yeah, it's a pretty good read. About 8,000 words.
Wow.
Good. So to switch gears, what's up in your world?
Oh, just finished up first semester of school.
Mm-hmm.
Figured wintertime slows down for me, so I learned how to push all these buttons on this camera. so I'll wrap that up last week. I've got a month off to kind of plan some stuff for the summertime, and then I go back to school the 17th of January until May, figure out what the other button on that camera does, and then be back at it doing some events and poker runs, things like that next summer. So trying to expand the model clientele and, you know, basically get my network out there just a little bit bigger than it is. So
I don't see where you would have a problem doing that. You're very good at what you do.
Thanks. You know, I have a lot of fun with it. So I figure as long as I'm having fun and the girls are happy, then I'm doing something right. But
exactly.
Every time I work with somebody, I'm learning something new. And I love that. I love the challenge, and I work with some great people. So most of that comes back on them for making me look good. So I've got another shootout first week of June. So I'm going to try to make it a little bigger than the one I did last year. So
that'll be cool.
Yeah, do make the fence so high they can climb over this time. Okay.
I know it, right? Oh, it was good times. Tell you what. So, but yeah, we got a few things in the works. Some of it I've got a kind of like a gag order on. I can't talk about it, but it's going to be good stuff, biker related, and I'll be calling in favors from anybody I can think of that wants to come down and be a part of that. And that'll be probably middle of July. And that's going to be a good situation for the biker community, as well as a big charity that we're going to be working with. So other than that, not a whole lot. Trying to get pictures caught up and, you know, get everything back on track.
So how many plants you got growing in the back now?
Oh,
yeah, it's legal there now.
I know it. Well, and you know, they've got it so restricted, which is, you know, if it's going to be legal, they've got all kinds of laws on it, pretty much the same as cigarettes and everything else. But, you know, it's, you'd figure the whole place would turn into a big puff of smoke, but it never really did. But it's not something I was really ever into anyhow, so that went through, and a lot of people are able to benefit from it, and local business is going, and that's one of the things that kept Colorado in the gray area was, you know, that revenue.
Yeah, but is that in your state only? I mean, you can't go from, like where you can carry it on your person. If you did it, can you carry it on your person and go to a different state or no?
You know, I would say probably not, because then that would be similar to interstate commerce if it's not legal there. It'd be like carrying anything from Canada to the U.S. or Mexico to the U.S. There's a different set of laws that
well, it's like going to Washington.
Serious trouble.
Go up to Washington and smoke all you want, but if you try and bring it back, you're going to get nailed under the federal law.
Right.
Isn't that crazy? I don't know. I don't do it, you know, so I guess I just assume that, say if you had a medical card for it, you know, so I'm assuming that you can go anywhere and have it on your person, meaning whether if it be, say, a brownie or something like that, because, you know, you have a card for it. That should override wherever you travel in the States, you know.
Well, I agree with you to an extent, but then that's also similar to, let's say, for instance, Utah, where there are certain counties that are alcohol-free. So if you have a dry county, you know, that's somewhat of a similar situation, I guess. It's
right.
Just different areas have their different laws.
That's true. But like I said, I don't know much about that because I don't do it. So, you know.
Right.
And I don't hate on the people that puff, puff, pass. That's their business,
right.
Not mine. You know, same with people that drink or whatever. That's their business. But,
right.
You know, like I said, I would just assume if you have a medical card for it, why can't you use it as long as you're in the States only?
Right.
You know, where you don't get in trouble. What's
you
the
know,
point
of
having
a
card
reasons.
If it's only... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. There's a lot of legitimate reasons.
Well, yeah, but if you look at, if you have a medical card, say in California, and you're traveling, and you just have an itty bitty amount. You know, why can't they make it to where, since it's used for medical reason only.
It doesn't work like that. Or you don't remember the guy that goes to hotels and with the dog and wipes it on the door and then they stop the car when it pulls out. I missed that one,
well,
Ryan.
You know, I never got into that, so I don't know.
Well,
I just assume if you have a medical card, it's almost like if you got a script for something, you know, you got a script. That can go anywhere with you.
No.
As long as it's in that bottle.
No,
and it is what it is.
The state laws, they're going against it. The feds aren't.
Mm-hmm.
The feds
well, it'd be like your concealed carry permit. If you have that and you go to a different state and they don't recognize it, you have to follow their applicable laws.
Yep.
So, you know, it's basically if it's something you're going to do, just be informed and make sure that you know what you're allowed to have where.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, you understand what I'm saying. It just doesn't make sense why you're only detained to have it in one state and you can't use it in other states. What is the point of having a medical card for something if you can't use it if you had to travel?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. It would be like you can go into a candy store, get a Snickers candy bar, but you can't bring it home. Kind of, sort of. You know?
No, I'd find a way to bring that Snickers bar home, trust me.
Well, but you know what I'm saying. You know, I mean, I had to use a different hypothetical because I don't do drugs.
Not a drug.
I use a different analogy.
It's not a drug if you're card.
Well, no, but okay. Okay. I stand corrected.
And, you know, honestly, now that there's a precedent for it, I think that a lot of the other states will follow suit. If you go back far enough in time in the medical field, there were times that they used forms of cocaine and over-the-counter type stuff. So as they learn about stuff and find out the pros and the cons of it, I think it'll go through more, I don't know if it'll become more lax, but I think it'll become more accepted to where it is allowed. If you have the card, they might allow you to go state to state or whatever.
Right.
But right now, I think that a lot of states don't recognize the medical capabilities of it, so they just kind of dismiss it as a narcotic. So
Bill and I
get that mindset fixed.
Bill and I have a friend who thought his med card was good in Texas, and he almost did 3 years.
Damn.
Right, yeah, and you don't want to do that in Texas. You end up in Tent City or the Horseshoe Prison, you're in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's crazy. But, you know, stuff I don't understand. It's okay. That's why we're on the show.
I think it's 480. Got a lot of background noise, but if you want to talk, I'll unmute you. See if we can get rid of all the noise.
Okay. I don't have it on speakerphone.
Well, I'd take it off speakerphone then.
All right, we're off speakerphone.
Okay.
Is that better?
Why, is Fran there?
No, she's not home yet.
Okay.
She usually gets home kind of late.
Yeah. So what do you think about all this?
I agree. If you have a prescription, you should be able to smoke it wherever you want to or whenever you want to. It's just like having a prescription for, like pain meds or psychotic meds or even just, like, Adderall or anything like that. I mean, an inhaler, albuterol. If you need it, you need it.
Yeah, I carry mine.
Yeah. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't really know any of the laws here in California, and I don't really know much about them in Arizona either, so.
Right. And we're so much on the forefront of it becoming any sort of a medical substance that there's going to be a lot of backlash, I think, for crossing state lines with it, and there's going to be a lot of people that don't really see the benefits for a little while yet.
I got news for you. Once they figure out how to tax it and package it, It'll be just like buying cigarettes.
Oh, yeah. Once they see the money generated off of that, you bet it will.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be nuts.
You know, there's the FBI and Department of Homeland Security are advising their agents to look out for people recording or taking pictures of federal buildings. They just came out with this. It's called, I put the link up in the chat room, but it's called a Suspicious Activity Reporting Bulletin. Among other things, the document warns its members to be on the lookout for those who photograph or video record security features, including cameras, security personnel, gates, and barriers. Now, Bill and I had a reporter friend from Quick Draw Magazine go down to the run to the VA, and she was taking pictures of the bikes coming in and taking pictures of the bikes going out. And they confiscated her camera. Building in the background.
Mm-hmm. In the city of Denver, you have to have a permit. If you're going to do any photography within the city limits, you're supposed to get a permit for it to make sure that that type of thing doesn't happen. And, of course, they're charging for the permit. But it's the same out here in the state parks. Anything that's going to be published or can be used for resale, you've got to have a permit for.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's another way to tax you and all that kind of stuff.
Just put a couple of links. Put a couple links up to that article.
You know, it's got its benefits, too. It's like some of the other laws they put in there. You know, it's out there to keep people from taking pictures of federal buildings to use later for terrorist attacks. At the same time, it's infringing on everybody else's right to go out there and, you know, take a family portrait because they wanted to have a picture in front of the Capitol building or anything like that. So, it's another way to kind of step in and have more control over things. And
well, when we went up to Mount Soledad and took pictures, and in the background you could see the VA building, and we're going to take the camera, and Fran's the one that took the pictures.
Right.
Oh, wow. Well, did anybody get in trouble?
No, there was one guy and about 300 bikers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that wouldn't have gone over very well.
No. Around his drawers.
Right. So how'd that run go?
Pretty good.
Nice.
We did pretty good that day. That was the day that a sergeant rolled up from the sheriff's department, and somebody called about the music. So Bill's on the mic, and he's talking to the crowd, and I point over, and he's not getting it, and he thinks I'm waving at him, and I'm pointing at the guy, and he's standing off to the right. So Bill calls him up and busts his balls a little bit. And tells him what everything's for and that. And he goes, well, I'll be on the other end of town for a couple hours. Bill said, yeah, we should be out of here by then. And then when we left, the guy drove by and everything was cool. But they sent him to shut it down. He wouldn't
right.
do it. He wouldn't do it because he was a vet.
Wow.
Yeah, there needs to be some common sense with situations like that. When you're getting a group of people together to generate money for somebody that's having hard times, some of those things need to be overlooked, and people need to quit bitching about it and just let it take place.
Mm-hmm.
You got too many people that are running around in their Prius that get pissed off when somebody's car is too loud or you drive an older truck and they're phone happy calling and reporting you for shit. Getting ridiculous.
A lot of things are getting ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And we're letting them happen because we keep voting the same idiots in that are doing the same shit over and over again.
Well, I got one for you. This is about, this will tell you how to.
This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, March 26, 2010.
Man, this is the deal with the police. I'm going to play this and you guys check it out.
I don't.
Then we'll come back for questions.
It's less clear. Even when you do know your rights, you're apt to waive them when the men with guns come knocking. Baltimore defense attorney William Billy Murphy is the narrator of the new film, 10 Rules for Dealing with Police. We spoke following an event for the film on Wednesday, started by discussing a show on which Murphy appears as himself, HBO's The Wire.
Well, interestingly enough, if you put aside Cosby, which is a little stylized, overly middle class, that was the first all-black show, which depicted black people as being intelligent no matter what their circumstances.
of the things that I think actually made the show, made all the characters in the show sympathetic, was because you actually understood the circumstances that they were dealing with and the realities of what they were actually into.
And how rational their choices were. And, you know, rationality does not guarantee correctness, you know that. But here were people acting rationally under these exceptional circumstances that had never before seen the light of true day, you know.
Well, let me ask you more about the direct stuff related to the film. I used to live in Kentucky, and one of the differences between Kentucky and Ohio is that in Ohio, when a police officer stops you, and when he is done executing the purpose of that stop, he is supposed to make you feel free to leave. That is the understanding that police have that exists basically nowhere else in the United States. And
yeah,
people,
right.
Forget that when they're dealing with cops, the questions that cops ask are questions that they ask hundreds of times, often in a week. All right, mind if I look in the trunk? And they segue directly into these requests for you to waive your rights effortlessly.
It's common all over the United States. Police are trained heavily in these areas to do exactly that, get people to waive their rights, and to be as effective about it as they possibly can. No question about it.
In interrogations, people, again, don't understand that when they're talking to police, they're talking to people who are trained specifically to get information out of you, especially in cases where you don't know that you're actually providing them with information.
There are two factors at work in interrogations and in police stops and encounters with citizens generally. One is the training about how to get people to give up their rights, and then there's the unspoken part, dealing with people of inherently less credibility, as far as the system is concerned, than the typical white cop or the typical black cop. Now, inherently less credible means that most white judges, most of the time, where there is one story from the police and one story from the black or brown citizen, will always believe their cop. And it's almost as bad if you're a white citizen. You know, cop gets up and says, going 80 miles an hour, gave me some attitude, blah, blah, blah. White citizen gets up and almost invariably, judge after judge after judge will take the word of that cop. So the cops rule the courtroom. The cops rule the courtroom. They are.
This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, July 3rd.
Dynamics behind that. And that's really more important than even their training and whatever. The reason judges are reluctant to disbelieve cops is because if they call a cop a liar or they say I'm not convinced or whatever, cop may lose his job, depending on how that judge handles it. If he says I've weighed the evidence and I have some doubt, I accept Officer So-and-so's version of the matter, but blah, blah, blah. If he's artful about it, cop goes on to live another day. And if that judge says to that cop, you know, I think you just lied to me. Ooh, man, that's the end of his career. Or the possible end of his career, subjects him to trial boards, inquiries, this, that, and the other. That builds in a built-in bias for the judge to be protective of that cop. Because, you know, if cops frequently lie, and they do, they're going to be frequent statements like that from an informed judiciary, and they're going to be frequent disciplinary actions until people wake up and, after decimating the local police force, realize that they can't lie in court.
I know empirical evidence is probably hard to come by on this, but how important can race be for otherwise identical people who are charged?
Well, first you got to look at whether they're going to be charged at all. And it's very unlikely if you're white and you're involved in regular drug uses that you're ever going to encounter the police. On the other hand, if you're black, you're usually in the inner city poor. Or without substantial means, you can't buy your drugs in quantities where it's economical for them to be delivered, or you can pick them up someplace off the street discreetly. So you're going to be involved in the street traffic. You're going to be seen. You're going to be visible. You're likely to be arrested sooner or later, or at least rousted or stopped or pushed around or whatever. So race matters. Now, it matters because black and brown people are in this position because of historical reasons. So there's an economic mismatch. And the economics reach the poverty level, it's easy to bust those people. It's easy to prosecute those people. They don't have the means to defend themselves. They have public defenders, usually from a poorly funded system. So the combination of historical race issues, resulting poor economics, you know, create this miserable situation where most of the people get locked up, prosecuted, arrested, investigated, of blacks and browns in the urban setting. Now, the federal court's a little different. Courts go after high-profile people to let the citizens believe that we don't distinguish between rich or poor, politically connected or not. So they go after elected officials, corrupt politicians, this, that, and the other. But even there, race matters because black politicians are over-investigated and over-prosecuted compared to their white counterparts. That's changing because the levels of corruption that we're seeing now are so extraordinary in the financial sector that those cases are getting the juice. But now on the side, the cases that still dominate the federal courts are black or brown drug gangs involved in violent behavior. Does that answer your question?
As a defense attorney, watching this from the inside, what should we do with the drug war in the United States?
We ought to as quickly as possible figure out, or at least get the political will, start the idea of legalizing drugs. We're in a situation now like we were in alcohol prohibition days. Because drugs have remained illegal for so long, it's illegal to distribute them, it's illegal to ship them, it's illegal to do anything with them. And so we put all of that drug trafficking in the hands of people who have no morality and who can't have their commercial disputes resolved in a court of law. He took my drugs. Well, that would be laughable. You know, he hijacked my shipment, Judge. I mean, that's laughable. So it's a completely lawless group of people from the beginning who stop at nothing to ply their trade. And the word drug pusher came because they actually push the drugs on the population. They are motivated to addict the population and to exploit that addiction by getting repeated sales. And all of this violence and all this gang behavior and all these criminal organizations exist because drugs are illegal. And so we have a choice. Do we want drug abuse with violence, with incipient lawlessness and disrespect for law, with incarceration, with all of the trappings that go along with the criminalization of drugs? Do we want drug abuse without any of that? And the choice is clear. It was clear with alcohol. It should be clear here. Now, the argument, the counter-argument is, lots of these drugs are really dangerous. Well, yes, that's true. They won't cease to be dangerous because we legalize them. They will cease to be associated with violence. And one of the things that we've learned over this last 38 years of criminalization, that drug usage is skyrocketing. Drugs are of higher potency than ever. Drugs are easier to get than ever. Sentences are higher and higher year by year. Rights have disappeared in our court system. And so family destruction is higher than it's ever been in these communities. The consequences of jail is that you go to a school basically to learn how to become a better criminal. So recidivism is higher and higher. It's a mess. So we have an ineffective way with gazillions of dollars where we could devote this money to education and treatment for people who find their way into the abuse of illegal drugs. So which do you want? And people act like there's a third option. There's no third option. It's either we legalize or we don't. We criminalize or we don't. We incarcerate or we don't. We have drug gangs who are violent or we don't. We have organized criminal activity or we don't. We have skyrocketing family destruction or we don't. We have AIDS that's out of control because jails are basically an AIDS incubator. You don't say, hey, fellas, you want some condoms? You know, most prison administrators refuse to do that. They refuse to acknowledge that situational homosexuality, forced rape, all those kinds of things are rampant in jails. We used to have an old saying when I was doing the day-to-day criminal stuff. 90% of the inmates who are in jail after 2 years are practicing gay sex, and the other 10% are liars. It's that bad. Unprotected gay sex.
It seems like police in a lot of communities that are poor and minority police don't have a lot of credibility. That is, people do not believe that their rights are going to be respected. What do projects like this one do to, if you believe that they do, help establish credibility between police and those kinds of communities?
Well, I think the thrust of the film is that even though it doesn't always work, even though there are no guarantees that it will work, you have to assert your rights because you have a better chance to survive the criminal justice system. On the other hand, nothing that I can foresee in my life will change the lack of credibility that the police have in urban areas. The jury's increasingly skeptical reaction to police testimony will have in urban areas. And so in Baltimore City, just like Philadelphia, like New York, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, you're seeing juries reject police testimony time and time and time again, where 30 years ago it would have been accepted. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, cops would have had some credibility. And I think we have to look at what the root of that is in order to solve the problem, and I have a theory about that. And that's why I'm so skeptical about whether or not it will ever change in our lifetime. The big change occurred when we motorized the police. We gave squad cars. Very little was written about it. Back when the decision was made to motorize the police so that they could be more nimble and more quickly responsive, it was talked about. But after it became fait accompli, we've ignored the impact motorized police force has on attitudes of the police population towards the police and vice versa. Here's what happened.
Does that create a disconnect then between them?
Huge disconnect. Because first of all, back in the day when I was coming up, the police walked the beat. And there wasn't much crime. It was regarded as a necessary, albeit slightly inefficient, way of patrolling. So the police got to know which kid in a particular family was the bad kid.
Yep.
Which family was trying hard to raise their kids. Who the good kids were. And there was a trust factor built into that community policing kind of attitude. You know, that cop. We got to know whether he's a good cop, whether he's a bad cop, whether he was an asshole, or whether he was a polite person. Whether he cared, whether he didn't care. And so these judgments were individualized. They were person-specific. Now they're not. Now it's 5-0. Now the cops are, from their point of view, going from a very isolated world where they don't know who they're dealing with into a dangerous world, and every episode they investigate is increasingly dangerous. And so their attitude is, these are some dangerous MFs out here. And, you know, be on your guard, have your hand on your gun, I got your back, this kind of stuff. You know, so it's a siege mentality. And from the black citizen standpoint, here they come again. They're going to mess us up. They're going to not honor our rights. They're going to just do the most vile things to us, get out of their way. There's hatred on both sides. Hatred on both sides. Because now when the black community or the brown community reacts with such venom to the police, the police, in turn, react as human beings everywhere would react. It reinforces these attitudes that they had from the beginning about this community. And so now the two communities are at total war with each other. It's easy to believe.
Mm-hmm.
William Billy Murphy is a Baltimore defense attorney and narrator of the new film 10 Rules for Dealing with Police. You can watch the full event at our website, Cato.
When things are at.
Yeah, that's everything on the head, you know. But then we go back to the same thing.
How about you, Eunice? What do you think?
What I just heard?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a black man talking to a white man and telling him what should really be done in the black communities. And,
well, basically, he meant everybody. He was just keying in on it. He had to plug his own, but he was...
Well, you know, you got pros and cons on that, you know. First of all, when the police used to walk the beat, it was a different era. Can you see them walking the beat now?
Yeah.
You know, I'd love to see him walking the beach somewhere. It's not going to happen, though.
Who's responsible?
Please fly.
Doing that right now.
Huh?
I said I was responsible for a couple of guys doing that right now.
Walking the beach?
Yep.
They doing laps around your house, or are you talking about something else?
No. Actually, in downtown, they haven't had anybody walking a beat since the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few incidents and a couple internal affairs interviews, and they were taking off their bikes, they're walking a beat downtown right now. At night,
that's
yes.
Kind of a safe area, though, isn't it, Phil?
Well, yeah, because everybody watches out for everybody down there, but nobody talks to them.
Right, but I'm saying it's a safe haven for the cops to walk the beach. I'd like to see them walking the beach in the projects around here. You know, it's not going to happen. The list of police here, they lie through their teeth. Very few of them are honest.
We had a woman cop lie in court. Proven in front of everybody. Now she's working.
She's working what?
She's in a car working in, down by all the factories and shit. I see her every morning when I go to work.
See, they never get penalized, you know? They don't get penalized.
They
ship them off. Well, yeah, if you got people like yourself and Bill and people that aren't afraid to fight them, you know? But how many people out of the population are willing to get up and fight against cops?
Well, you should have did that when he gave you that ticket.
Well, I should have, but you know something? It was more important for me to go to Florida. And I know that's a poor answer.
Well, priorities. If I had 10 people, 9 of them said, fuck it, I'm just going to pay it. What good is it to?
Yeah, no. I'm going to waste my time. You know, I was wrong. You know, let's face it, I was wrong. But, you know, I took the responsibility for that. So, but I don't know. I really don't know. Who else will we get on tonight?
Oh, we got Ryan from Colorado and Laura's in Chicago.
Hey, girls, hi.
Hi.
Ryan's not a girl.
No.
Yeah, he's a boy.
Oh, nice to meet you.
You too. Who am I talking to?
Eunice.
Okay. I don't think I've ever been on when you were on before.
No, she hasn't been on when you've been on with us, Ryan. That's why she didn't know that you were a male.
Oh, it's all good.
Well, so they said you're Chicago, so I just assumed it was our friend from Chicago. But you can be our friend,
that's
too.
Me.
You know.
Yes.
There we go. Am I allowed in to hang out with the cool kids then?
Oh, yeah. You can hang out.
In fact, Eunice, why don't you what you're responsible for doing?
And it looks pretty good now, Phil. There was an article in the paper yesterday that they're ready to pass this bill.
Good.
It's a bill to protect our children against pedophiles. And,
good.
It's something I've been working on for...
forever.
Actually, 34 years, and it was in the Judiciary Committee for the last 10 years. Actually, it's going into the 11th year, and we finally got it out of there after screaming and yelling and calling the president of the Judiciary Committee an asshole. Sometimes you get angry, but I say it in a nice way, you know. I tell them to go fuck themselves.
Well, you know,
sometimes
when,
you have to do that.
When it deals with
you know?
Innocent kids in a situation like that, I'm sorry, but you'd think they'd pull their head out of their ass and realize what the priorities are and kind of
bring
that to the front of the
pile. Wait, this is going to get better because the bill they passed before this one was to protect pets
from abusive relationships. They
well,
passed
that
about
was illegal
a month
in most states. Idiot.
Well, they didn't have a bill in Massachusetts, but they passed that bill before they passed this bill. And, of course, you know that the insurance companies and the non-profitable organizations like the Catholic Church is one of the biggest ones. pay, the lobbyists pay, you know, a lot of our representatives, and you have 15 people on the Judiciary Committee who are representatives, but they're also defense lawyers. And they try to keep this really down. I had to go before him in May, I think it was. I mean, I've been before him so many times, I lose track.
Right.
And I very bluntly, you know, told the chairperson of Flaherty that this was not a church thing. The state and church are supposed to be separated, and it's about time he learned how to do that.
Right.
He made a comment in the newspaper that someone embarrassed him. Some woman embarrassed him. Because I did
tell
him.
Well, shame on you.
I did tell him that that if I lived in his area, I'd be running against him, and I would win. Total asshole.
Mm-hmm.
He come out this day, and it's the first time in 10 years he's ever taken his gavel and kind of hit it on the table and said, there'll be no comments made, no applause, no, you know, booing, nothing until this whole meeting is over. And if somebody does this, then I am going to clear the hall. And there was like 300 people in there, and I had this NFL football player sitting beside me. And I wish I could tell you his last name, but it's like John Doe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I can tell you that his first name was Al, and he played for the Philadelphia Major League football team. And he had been sexually abused by a police officer. And he was sitting next to me. And the Attorney General got up and spoke first. And O'Flaherty made it very clear that he was going to let a professional person speak first. And then looking straight at me, because I always sit in front of him, and then we'll have a lay person speak. And that's what happened. And I was like the second person called. Usually he always kept me to the end. I just told him, you know, the way it was, and that I was tired of his bullshit, and I totally embarrassed him because we had sent people to his office in the morning, and his aide, who was a beautiful young blonde, was very rude to these people. So I said there was three things that I was going to say. And I very nonchalantly told him that he looked great because he put weight on. I did, you know. That was to throw him off. And then I said, we sent people to your office today. And your aide, who was sitting next to you, was very rude to these people. And I says, that's one thing I will not have. You better never have your aide be rude to anybody that comes to talk about this bill to protect our children.
Uh-huh.
I says, and thirdly, I says, I would run against you because I don't like you very much, and I don't think too many people like you. So when the news media went to him, he said that he was going to resign at the end of this year. Because somebody totally embarrassed him. So when
I
got
done, his little feelings.
Well, that's too bad. You know,
yeah.
He's hurt mine for 10 years.
Yeah.
But I kept coming back. So when I got up to leave, everybody stood up and they applauded, and he took the gavel and he's banging it and screaming over the mic that he was going to clear this room. You know. So Al, the football player, stood up and in a very deep voice said to him, Representative O'Flaherty, there'll be no clearing this room at all. That's the mother of the survivors, and she will get all the applause because she's entitled to it. And
nice.
I just walked out the door.
Nice.
But it's been a hard fight, and we are going to win. And if we don't, then I'm going to destroy them. And Carmen Dursel and Mitchell Garabedian said it very well, that when the representatives speak to me and the senators speak to me, they all cross their legs. And I says, you're right, because I'll take every one of their balls.
Mm-hmm.
I like that thought.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love to have that kind of reputation that they're afraid of me, you know. I don't know what for. I'm a 71-year-old woman. I couldn't blow a bag up if I wanted to.
No.
I'm
but
still
I
trying to wrap my mind around those bastards putting this off for 10 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know.
What a crock of shit. I mean, and he's
being
arrogant that he's going to clear the room if anybody talks about a pedophile bill. What an ass.
Yeah. You know,
but you don't understand. There are so many others out there that we don't even know.
Yeah,
right.
It's disgusting. There's like 350 children a day in Massachusetts are being sexually abused. We just had a case up here. It just broke out last week that a gentleman whose wife had a daycare center raped an 8-day-old baby. Raped an 8-day-old baby. And he has been under the scope since 2009. They knew that he was a pedophile.
And they did nothing about it.
They did nothing. And he raped not just an 8-day-old baby, but several of the children that his wife was taking care of.
Wow.
You know, there's a special place in hell for sick bastards like that.
Well, you know, he's not going to make it in jail.
No.
He's not. They'll get rid of him. That's one thing.
Honestly, I hope they don't get rid of him. I hope that every day is a pillowcase party for the rest of his life, and he's just beaten to the point of about moving on, and then they let him heal and do it all over again.
Let me tell you something. I'm sorry, what was your first name?
Ryan.
Brian.
Brian. You know, see, I'm getting old, Brian, so I forget. See?
It's all good.
My son was murdered in 82. And when I went to the trial of the kid that murdered him, his father was sitting on a bench outside, and the guy was crying, and I knew people that knew the father. He was a real hardworking man. And I went over to him, and I was sitting with two detectives, and they said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going over and talk to the man. And, of course, he was a little gun-shy because he didn't know what I was going to do. And
right.
I said to him, Mr. Murray, please don't, you know, I'm not here to scream at you. We have no control over what our children do. You know, once they leave home, we can only teach them what we can teach them, but whatever they learn on the street is, you know, more powerful than what we can teach them. And he says, I'm so sorry for what my son did. I says, you don't have to apologize to me. I'm just sorry that you're going to have to pick up where I left off, because my son had been in jail. And about 3 months later, I had a dear friend who was in Walpole. That's one of the biggest. What do they call it? Junction now? I'm not sure.
What's that?
Walpole. They don't call it Walpole anymore. There's another name for it. That's the biggest prison. You know, if you get a life sentence, that's where you're going. And I had a friend
there,
that was here. Yeah, and he said, the kid's dead. And I said, no, Tommy, I don't want him dead. I just want him fucked every day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to him. And his father got in touch with me. And he says, Eunice, I got to tell you what's happening to my son. And I listened to him. And I said, you know, Mr. Murray, I have no control over that, which I did. I says, but you can go see him. I have to go to the cemetery and see mine. And I felt bad for this guy. I really did, you know, because it's not We can only teach them the best to our knowledge, you know, about life. But I really believe that if you're weak and you're out on the street, you learn very quickly how to become a leader. And, and it happens, you know. It's the devil
and the leaders,
the devil.
The leaders are always the one taking down first.
Yep.
Because without the head, the body can't survive.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, and I've had a lot of tragedies in my life, and I've pulled myself up by the boots and you know, I had learned how to forgive, only so I could forgive myself, you know. And it's, you know, it's what you do with your life. And I try to do the best I could. And the reason, and I've said it before, Bill, the only reason people get involved in this stuff is if it happens in their family. And like I said, my son in 1980 was sexually abused by a priest.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew what pedophilia was at that time, but I had made my mind up at that time that we had to do something to protect our children. And believe me, I fought with some of the top and some of the best. And if I leave anything, you know, it's going to be this legacy that we are going to protect our children. And those bastards aren't going to be taught, you know, slapped on the hand anymore. First time out, Charlie Brown, you're going to jail.
Right.
And let's see how they like getting raped up the ass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'll probably enjoy it, but I'm sure they won't just use a penis. They'll use a broomstick. So, and I'm not afraid to say that publicly. And I think that's what really scares a lot of people. That, I'm not afraid to say that. What can they do to a 71-year-old woman, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing much.
Right.
And I will prevail. And these insurance companies aren't going to work. They're not going to win this time. And I've said this before, and I'm just going to repeat it to Brian, but the 31st of July when the senators pulled the bill to save it, the lobbyists were very, very upset. This was like 10:30 at night. And they all leave the balcony and at the Senate. And I'm running to the ladies' room, and one of them very nonchalantly said, "I don't know who the fuck she knows, but she's the one that got it pulled." Well, if I could have held my bladder, I would have, but I just kept going. Come back and tapped him on the shoulder. And he was standing with about six lobbyists, and I said to him three things. And he looks at me, you know, totally embarrassed. And the others are standing there very quietly. And Carmen and Mitchell was standing, you know, across the corridor, but, you know, probably only 4 feet away. And I looked at Carmen, and he knew what was going to happen. And I said to the guy three things. First, you don't know how to say fuck right. And he looked at me, you know. And I said, secondly, remember the name, it's Eunice White. I says, and thirdly, you want to know who got this bill pulled? God. God got this bill pulled. And fourth, I'm going to throw it in. You're not getting paid this week. And I walked away. And Thomas says, I don't know where you come up with it, Eunice, but you always have an answer for these guys. And I think God gave me the wits to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my woe for today, and I feel good. I spoke at a meeting tonight and, about this bill in a church. And it went very well. One person asked me where I got the stamina to keep fighting all these years. And I says, because God, our God, anybody's God, or higher power, or whoever you want to call them, these are his children that priests are raping.
Well,
you know, they're his children. So I don't have to answer for these priests, but these priests are going to have to answer to whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they're going to put me on the staircase up there to check them out and so I can kick them down the flight of stairs.
There you go.
So we'll just see. And I'll let you know, Phil. It's supposed to happen next week. And I'll know more at the end of this week. And when it does, I'll be on the show.
That's before the Christmas break, right?
Yes. Well, they go into session. See, the way they do it now, they don't call them into session. What they do is they can call in their vote.
Yeah, in California, all they got to do is drive by the parking lot.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully we're hoping that it's going to go national, you know, federal law.
Do you have any links or anything that talk about this bill that we can start getting the word out on it, or is it kind of hush-hush until it gets through the...
No, we've been talking about it for how long now, Phil?
A couple of months.
Yeah,
okay,
a couple of months.
Could you throw a link up for me, Phil, if you have one?
Hermes has a link on it.
Yeah, I have to look for it, but what I can do is... if Eunice says it's okay, I'll send you her phone number and you can talk to her.
Sure.
Okay.
That'd be great, you know. That would be great. It's, like I said, we really wanted to go federal, and I think that's what's going to happen. I know the state of Florida has already asked me, the House of Representatives has asked me if I would help them get a bill going like this down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's going to be other states that are going to ask the same thing because, you know, the story is this woman only went to the seventh grade. And I'm proud of that. And
mm-hmm.
I'll tell you why, because I'm self-taught. And it's amazing when people say to me, you know, how far did you go in college? And when I tell them I only went to the seventh grade, they go, what? But I made sure that my children graduated from high school and went to college. And I'm proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
I worked hard to do that. And they have good lives. Some don't, some do. But you want to know something? They have to take on their own responsibility. Because I took mine on,
right.
That's the bottom line. They're not your children when they become 50 years old. And I love them, don't get me wrong. I love them. And they just, I sometimes wonder where they were when they passed the brains out to them, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, until I was 13, I thought my name was Shut Up.
Well, that's true. I used to have a lot of nicknames. Uterus, useless, you know. But I was never afraid to leave home at 15. Then when I was 18, I went to New York and danced at the Latin Quarters for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had a kind of interesting life. And I'm trying to get the book out there, and I have other people helping me, Phil. So
yeah,
I was told just to do 100 pages and then just do follow-up ones. So that's what I'm going to do. And it will be nice. I went not to let people tell me what to do. So... So when is Phil coming back?
Maybe Thursday. I talked to him today. Maybe Thursday.
Oh, good. He's feeling better then.
Well, he's been riding since Sunday.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
He was there all day Monday, and he was there till about 1. Then he went and did some errands, and he kind of got run down. And then he was there today. He stayed pretty much
today. So he's going to see, he's just doing it day by day to see how he feels.
Well, you told him I said hello.
I told him that he knows that everybody's, he might be, like, Thursday, he might just pop in here for a little bit and then take off, but right now he's just day by day.
Well, that would be good. Be good to talk to him.
Yeah. He's,
you know?
Yeah, he's got a lot of bent up anger right now, so yeah, he'll be on a roll.
Yeah. They wanted me to stay longer after the meeting, and I said, oh, God, no, I'm on a radio show. They'll miss me if I don't show up.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you came on. It's good to hear what you're doing, and I'll do what I can to spread the word out here, but that's definitely something we need to get in every state.
Yeah, yeah. It's. I just did a five-mile area around my house, and I live, I don't want to say in the rich part of town, but it's not the lower part of town either, you know. And
so you're in a middle-class neighborhood.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm between middle-class and high-class. It doesn't matter. I could care less, you know.
Uh-huh.
But 178 of them around me in a 5 miles zoning area.
Yeah, there's 136 in a 5 mile radius around me.
Yeah. So tell me this doesn't have to be really worked on. Because you can never cure these people, ever. They can never be cured. You know?
Right.
You can rip their tongues out, cut their fingers and toes and the penis, and but they'll find a way, you know? And they actually blamed, the priest blamed my son and said at 6 years old, he come on to him. 6 year-old boy, come on to him.
Wow.
And the Catholic Church knew that this man had a problem, and they still ordained him, you know, so. But that's been going on in the Catholic Church for years and years, and not just the Catholic Church, you know. It's gone on many, many places. We have a case up here with Children's Hospital. They had a doctor here for years that molested. He was a pediatrician. And the hospital knew it, had several complaints, and covered up for him. The same thing with Penn State, you know. It's because they don't want to ruin the name, you know. But you have to make these people accountable for it, you know. You have to, and the only way you can do that is to take their monies. And let me tell you, going through this with my son, he took his monies, which wasn't a lot, and he donated it. And it's not a question of the money; it's the satisfaction of knowing that one way or the other, and the priest was ousted after all these years. Only to do what he did before, you know, not as a priest, but as a civil person.
Yeah.
So, and that's why these are the laws that we've been trying to pass, so that it could be 30 years down the road and they can still be prosecuted. So, there's a lot of aspects to this bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I know the insurance company's not going to win this time.
No, and they own so much property.
Do you know the insurance policies that the Catholic churches carry? $1 billion insurance policies.
Yeah.
When they say we're closing the church, and they try to specify it because they're being sued, that's not true. They're closing churches because they can't get priests to run them anymore.
No.
Or they have to put millions of dollars into them, which they don't want to do.
Right.
You know, so people get the wrong impression. You know, people say to me, hey, you know, you're still a Catholic? Well, my God didn't want this. It wasn't my faith that wanted this. Was the people in charge and the person that did it. And those are the ones that have to be punished. So it's, you know, they're not pushing me out, and you know, they've lost a lot of parishioners. But those parishioners were looking for an excuse to leave. So this was their best excuse.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, you know, if it's, you want to believe that, then you believe it. If you don't want to believe it, you don't believe it, you know.
Well,
they have to question themselves.
Yeah. You know, I got this thing right now. It's like 47 years old. I don't know if you guys remember who it was. He made this thing. It's called If I Were the Devil. Let me play this. I want you guys to listen to this.
I were the devil. If I were the devil. If I were the prince of darkness, both the whole world in darkness. I have a third of its real estate and four-fifths of its population, but I wouldn't be happy until I had seized the ripest apple on the tree. Thee. So I'd set about however necessary to take over the United States. I'd subvert the churches first. I'd begin with a campaign of whispers. With the wisdom of a serpent, I would whisper to you as I whispered to Eve. Do as you please. To the young, I would whisper that the Bible is a myth. I would convince them that man created God instead of the other way around. I would confide that what's bad is good and what's good is square. And the old I would teach to pray after me, Our Father, which art in Washington. And then I'd get organized. I'd educate authors in how to make lurid literature exciting so that anything else would appear dull and uninteresting. I'd threaten TV with dirtier movies and vice versa. I'd peddle narcotics to whom I could. I'd sell alcohol to ladies and gentlemen of distinction. I'd tranquilize the rest with pills. If I were the devil, I'd soon have families at war with themselves, churches at war with themselves, and nations at war with themselves until each in its turn was consumed. And with promises of higher ratings, I'd have mesmerizing media fanning the flames. If I were the devil, I would encourage schools to refine young intellects, but neglect to discipline emotions. Just let those run wild. Until before you knew it, you'd have to have drug-sniffing dogs and metal detectors at every schoolhouse door. Within a decade, I'd have prisons overflowing. I'd have judges promoting pornography. Soon I could evict God from the courthouse, then from the schoolhouse, and then from the houses of Congress. And in his own churches, I would substitute psychology for religion and deify science. I would lure priests and pastors into misusing boys and girls and church money. Devil, I'd make the symbol of Easter an egg and the symbol of Christmas a bottle. If I were the devil, I'd take from those who have and give to those who want it until I had killed the incentive of the ambitious. What'll you bet? I couldn't get whole states to promote gambling as the way to get rich. I would caution against extremes in patriotism, moral conduct. I would convince the young that marriage is old-fashioned, that swinging is more fun, that what you see on TV is the way to be. And thus I could undress you in public, and I could lure you into bed with diseases for which there is no cure. In other words, if I were the devil, I'd just keep right on doing what he's doing. Paul Harvey. Good day.
That was 47 years ago. Does it ring a bell?
Yeah. Sure does. Sure does.
Do you have that in the text of that or just on a recording?
No, I have a recording.
Okay. I'll have to see if I can find that all written down somewhere.
Well, all you got to do, I can, let me see, I'll put it to you. I'll do it for you right now. I'll send it to you.
Right on.
Here's the first part. Here's the link. There you go, right there.
Cool, got it.
Just copy and paste it.
Right on.
But Yeah, we're down to the last 4 minutes. I invite everybody to stop in Thursday.
All right, Phil. You can give Brian my number if you want.
I will. And if
is there a 2 hours difference there, Brian?
Yeah, right now it's 9 o'clock.
Yes, if you want to call me, I'm still up. It's 11 here.
Okay.
All
yeah,
righty, guys.
As soon as we get up here.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if Bill confirms he's coming, I'll let you guys.
Yeah, let me know, and that package goes out tomorrow morning for you.
Okay, cool.
I finally got it wrapped, so.
Perfect.
I have just been straight out, really, Phil. You know,
okay. No worries.
So I'm going to get out in the mail tomorrow, so you should get it in a few days.
Okay, thank you.
All righty, my friend.
Uh-huh. And I'm going to take us out with Everlast, and it's called What It's Like. And talk to you guys Thursday.
All right.
Good work, you guys.
Take
have
care.
A good night.
Good night,
to you again.
Good night.
Walking through the door. They call her a killer and they call her a whore.